Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Every human being is an unrepeatable event, right? You've got to find what it is about your curiosities and your capacities that is unrepeatable, that is irreplaceable, because that's the thing that puts you above the plane of competition and on the plane of creativity. I'm not threatened by the possibility of anyone taking my job, not because I think I'm better than everyone else, but because I know how unique I am, that nobody even wants what I want.
Right.
It's not that you can't beat me at the game that I'm playing. It's that the game that I'm playing is so optimized for me, it would put the rest of the world to sleep. No one is interested in my game but me. And that's the level you want to get to in life, where you're the only one who even wants to play the game you're playing, because it's so connected to your own curiosities and interests that you become the dominator of that game.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Monday, December 10th, and I am very excited to be presenting to you a conversation with one of our most requested guests, TK Coleman, who is the education director at Praxis. And you know, I wrote a big long outline for this show. We didn't even touch it, because I realized, even though TK and I have a lot of overlap in our circles of colleagues, we had never talked before. And thus, we had a lot to talk about. So I just let it flow. I originally planned to have TK on to talk about a video series that he is currently developing on the Praxis YouTube channel. I think he says there's 7 episodes out currently. It is called TK's College Tour of Bad Arguments, where he helps people deal with the common objections or concerns that people present when a young person talks about opting out of college. Many of these objections suggested by Praxis participants. So TK and I are planning a second installment for this conversation, where we will dive deep into that subject. We do scratch the surface of it today, but as I'm doing an interview, I have an outline, you know, and when we talk about something, I highlight it in yellow just as a helpful reminder, you know, that I don't need to talk about that again because it's already in the show. But the point was, I highlighted nothing. And I still thought the conversation was amazing, but I'm going to have him back so I can highlight all that stuff. I can't leave it unhighlighted. I'll go mad. I would also like you to join me after the conversation. I'm going to read an excerpt from a book that I mentioned to TK, and it fit into the context of what we were talking about. If I read it to you now, it's going to seem a little out of place, and I explain it very, very quickly when it comes up in the conversation. So I just wanted to give you a fuller picture. It's a book called Grammatical Man. And I'll read you the excerpt that I was talking about that gave me bad feelings, an excerpt that made me angry at just about everybody in the world. So stay tuned after the show for that. But now, I am very pleased to present on School Sucks, finally, TK Coleman.
I'm ready, man.
Let's just start like this. Let's get to know each other on the show, because we've never talked before. I will introduce you as TK Coleman. You're the education director for Praxis. In the past, I've had Isaac on the show. I've had Zach on the show. I've had Derek McGill on the show. And they've all talked about what Praxis is and what Praxis does. but I'd like to hear your take on Praxis.
Here, you know, I'll tell it in the form of a story because I love stories. And one of my favorite quotes is, I believe it's a Native American proverb that says something along the following lines: tell me a truth and I will know, tell me a fact and I will believe, but tell me a story and it will live in my heart forever.
Yes.
So here's a story that I like. There's a story about a man who walked around on an island with a boat on his back. And whenever people would stop him and ask him about why he has a boat on his back, he would say, well, this boat is what got me here. Once upon a time, I lived in a faraway land and I dreamed of making it to this island. And this was the boat I built in order to get here. And this boat stuck with me through many hard times. And now that I'm here, I commemorate it. I celebrate it by bearing it on my back. And it became a badge of honor. And everyone would look at him in that boat and they would think to themselves, wow, what a man of perseverance, you know? Mm. And then one day he comes across a guru who says, tell me again, why do you have that boat on your back? And he says, well, you know, he gives the long story about what it was like back in the day and how this was the boat that got him to the island and how he would have never made it to the island without that boat. And then the guy says, okay, so do you plan on staying here? And he says, oh, of course, this island is where I've dreamt of being. And he says, well, relieve yourself of the boat and travel lightly. The boat has served its purpose. And what was once a badge of honor has now become a burden. Leave it behind. And I think that is a great symbol for the traditional approach to higher education. Once upon a time, traditional credentials like college degrees were like that boat. You had somewhere you wanted to get, and that boat, that degree was the thing based on the way the world operated, based on our limited capacity to signal information, based on the knowledge gap, based on the, you know, the nature of institutions. You needed that degree, or at least it seemed to be that way.
Yeah.
And people use that degree to get somewhere. And what was once just meant to be a means to an end became a badge of honor. It became a symbol of sacrifice. It became a status symbol where people praised each other merely for having it, even if what they used it for was something that they themselves complained about. So we live in a world where people don't even like their jobs. They don't even like their lives. They complain about being overworked and underpaid. But hey, I got that degree.
Yeah.
Right? And they feel proud of themselves for having that badge of honor. They have that degree. And so I think the conversation that needs to happen around higher education today is similar to the one that the guru had with that man, and say, hey, that has served its purpose. And it is now a new day and a new era. And that requires a new way. You've got to leave that boat behind, or you yourself are going to get left behind because you're weighed down by something that is a symbol of the past. And we can praise it for what it did. We can appreciate it for getting us here, but we've got to move on and we've got to start having new conversations. And Praxis is a part of that new conversation. We're changing the conversation around higher education. And for us, the conversation centers not around what institution are you a part of, or what credential are you holding in your hand, or what roadmap are you following. For us, the conversation centers around how are you striving to become your own credential? How are you striving to signal your ability to create value by your body of work? I don't want to know how much you paid for a course. I don't want to know what institution you went to. I want to know what you're doing and what you can do to make the lives of other people better, because that's the only thing that matters when it comes to your career or when it comes to just making your way in the world. And that's what we're in the business of helping young people do through our apprenticeship program. So that's kind of how I see things in story form.
Outstanding. I so much more positive than my cynical observation that people love using an argument for how things are as a response to an argument for how things could be. Right. And this is one of the arguments that is trotted out most frequently for the continuation of the acceptance of this way of doing things when it comes to college.
Right. Right. I just recently encountered this in the form of, you know, the recent news about companies like Google saying we're removing the college degree requirement from our talent searches now.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of major companies that are doing this. And I'm absolutely astonished at the number of people who respond to that by saying, yeah, sure, but that's only, you know, 12, 13 companies.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Still, there are hundreds of companies over here that are not doing that. And I think the fundamental flaw in that way of thinking is that they're not thinking directionally. And when you're having a conversation about preparing for the future, which is what any conversation about education must be, education
right.
isn't about validating your current existence. Education is about preparing for the future. And if you're having that conversation, you have to think directionally. You have to ask yourself, what is the world on its way towards looking like in the next 2 years, in the next 5 years? If you have a 16-year-old, 17-year-old, 18-year-old, you're preparing them for college, you don't want them being prepared for the world that worked for you. You want them being prepared for the world that's coming into existence and that is going to exist in 5 years. So you have to know how to think in terms of trend analysis,
mm-hmm.
right? So, you know, if for some reason Amazon Fresh isn't available in my neighborhood, I don't use that to negate the presence of such a thing or the power of such a thing. But if I look at the way the trends are going, I say it's only a matter of time before it comes to my neighborhood. You know, so you got to ask yourself when you see things like this, well, what direction are we moving in? Are we moving in a direction where we can expect less of this or more of this? So if the leading companies are saying we no longer care about degrees, do you think there's going to be more of that or less than that in a few years? If the companies that everyone else are trying to, you know, everyone else is trying to imitate are moving in that direction, that often gets left out of the discussion.
Right. Now, TK, you don't know this about me, and I am so sorry to the people in my audience who are hearing this story for the 200th time, but I was a freshman in college in 1995 in a far less dynamic world than we live in today. My major was communications. So newspaper, television, all of this was covered under this major. I entered school in 1995, and for 4 years, I learned about how television news packages were shot in the 1980s and how newspapers were laid out in the 1970s. And I graduated into a new century where everything I learned had become irrelevant in just 4 years. Mm. And nobody told us about that while I was in school. So I have that story. I regard it as a positive experience, certainly a transformative experience. As a professional later in my career, within a year, I worked as a college consultant with, Ivy League bound or at least overachievers from wealthy school districts around Boston, Massachusetts. That same year, I was starting a business of my own in New Hampshire doing tutoring. And my day job to make money during that time was working as a technical recruiter in the year 2009. And seeing the amount of bureaucracy, even in non-government jobs, trying to put people into these positions and the roadblocks that I would encounter. People had amazing CVs and I couldn't get them through the door because they did not have a college degree. And I started to realize how tragic that was, that I couldn't match up what I clearly was able to determine was the best person for that job, the best available person for that job. And I couldn't even get them through the door for an interview.
So those are some experiences that I'm bringing to this conversation that shaped my opinions on this issue.
But I wanted to talk a little bit about what you're bringing to this conversation as well. I've heard you say, I know you went to college, you had a positive experience there. You went to public school and had a positive experience there. And I like the effort to avoid antagonism in a conversation like this.
What you're doing is more the promotion of choice than just a blanket criticism of college.
So talk a little bit about your background as far as, your college experience and what you brought into this current endeavor, the work you do with Praxis. We're also going to talk about a video college tour that you're doing for the Praxis YouTube channel where you're helping people deal with common objections to opting out of college. A lot of these things were suggested by Praxis participants. But how did you get here? Let's talk a little bit about your school and college experience first.
Sure. So like you, I definitely enjoyed my college experience, just like I enjoyed childhood. I don't want to go back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to go back. But boy, did I have a good time during that stage of my life. And it's so very important to me when I talk about the subject of alternative higher education that people understand nothing that I say, nothing that I do is driven by hatred for what is or what was, but by a passion for what is not yet, a passion for what can be. And that we celebrate things like possibility. We romanticize things like possibility, but possibility is also tragic because it requires us to divorce ourselves from the realities that the current realities that we love that are going to be transformed by those new possibilities. So, you know, I enjoy taxis. Once upon a time, I enjoyed using fax machines before we had wireless cell phones. Right. I enjoyed the phones with the old school phones, like the, you know, where you had the long cords and all that. I enjoyed all that, man. That was awesome stuff. but we have new technologies and new possibilities now, and you don't have to get defensive about what worked for you back in the day in order to say, yeah, but we can do a lot of this stuff in a much more efficient way, in a much more playful way. And so forth. And that's how I see the whole education thing. But for my background, I went to college at the University of Western Michigan in Kalamazoo. And I initially studied theater because that was my first love. I discovered plays, you know, back in high school. A buddy of mine, we auditioned for a play as a joke, and we both made it. And the joke was on us, and we both loved it.
what was the play?
That first one was Oklahoma.
Oh yeah,
it was a musical, and we had the time of our lives, man. We had the time of our lives, and I hope I'm getting it right. If my high school drama teacher, Mrs. White, is listening to it and happened to be a different play, and I'm remembering it incorrectly.
Oh, she listens.
But you know, so that was my first love, and that's what I went to college for. I went on a theater scholarship, and. The possibilities before me at that time was maybe this is something that I teach. I become a college professor of theater, or maybe I go pursue acting in New York or LA, something along those lines, or I learn how to write plays and direct them. But I also grew up in a very, very religiously conservative home where we spent a lot of time in church. My father was a pastor, and I spent more time in church services in my first 10 years than most people will experience in their entire lifetime. And so I did not have much exposure to other religions or even other political demographics. And, you know, I had a pretty narrow way of seeing things in that regard. And college was somewhat of a culture shock for me. And it sent me into a crisis of faith, if you will, that led me to philosophy. I started asking all sorts of questions as I'm meeting wonderful people that have different religious beliefs than me, or wonderful people who were atheists, but they were great friends. And I started to ask myself, well, how do I know if what I believe is true? And how do you know if anything is true? Like, how do you know that you know something? What constitutes good evidence? And I didn't know at this time that there was a name for that. And one day I was at home, and my brother had these articles on his desk because he actually went to Bible school. And they were articles by Ravi Zacharias, a Christian apologist. And I remember one of them was called The Logic of Sesame Street. And he was using like children's like stories to talk about philosophy. And I fell in love with that. And I said, I got to know what this is called. And I found out that that was called philosophy. When I went back to school, I went straight to the philosophy department. And I went to the chairperson's office. And I said, I want to study philosophy. This is my major. And he says, whoa, whoa, whoa. Have you taken any courses in philosophy yet? And I said, I haven't. And he said, well, you might want to try it out first before you declare it as a major. And, you know, just to know if you like it, I wouldn't want you wasting your time. And I said, oh, no. I stayed up all night reading Ravi Zacharias articles. I want more. This is where I need to be. This is my place. This is my home. And I never looked back. I declared my major in philosophy, and I absolutely loved it. I had some of the greatest teachers in the world. Even to this day, one of my greatest friends, one of my greatest mentors, if you happen to hear this, forgive me for not talking enough with you, is Tim McGrew, who is a college professor of philosophy, an expert in epistemology and philosophy of science, and one of the brightest people I know, and one of the most wonderful people that I know, and has had a profound impact on my life. And so for me, I stuck with philosophy. And even though when I graduated college, my first job was as a financial advisor, it was my philosophical background that really helped me learn how to learn, so that no matter what it was I tried, I realized that the most important skill in life is the ability to learn and the ability to think in terms of principles. Because when you can do that, it doesn't matter what your job is or what your major is, you can apply the fundamental aspects of whatever you do and learn to anything else that you want to do and learn. And so that was just a really great experience for me. And my social experience was equally good. I wasn't bullied at college. I met many wonderful people. And it was just an awesome time. And I personally hope that college succeeds. I think in order for it to succeed, like anything good, it needs to be challenged by healthy competition. It needs to be held accountable by healthy competition. It needs to be criticized. And it needs to be something that is looked at. It needs to be something that, you know, we have honest conversation about in order for it to do what it does best. Because right now, college is in the business of doing all sorts of things that I think could be done, that are already being done in a much better way by trade schools, by apprenticeships. It doesn't work for everyone. And I would like to see college get back to doing what it ought to be doing. I love it so much that I want to compete with it and critique it.
Okay, you mentioned your desire to see college succeed. What do you feel college does well? What would you like to see college do more of? And I guess this is also probably a pretty good place to slip in what college should be doing perhaps a little less of.
I still have not seen anything out there in the world that provides you with an environment where socially you can be around people that are your age, lots of people that are your age, and be somewhat insulated from a lot of the real world responsibilities that come with adulthood, right? You kind of get, a lot of people, you know, they kind of get defensive about this, but, you know, I think we just have to be honest about what it is. You kind of get to push the pause button on being held to normal adult standards of responsibility for 4 years.
Okay. You know? Yeah.
If you go to college, you know what I mean?
Well, like, yeah, because usually this would be a bad argument, right? Like to say, oh, well, you're just shielded from, you know, we always talk about the ivory tower, the bubble, when maybe more of the political activities in college, that a lot of this is just disconnection from how things actually work in the world. But yeah, you've just come out of, if you're the average, American high school graduate, you've just come out of 15,000 hours of your life being directed by somebody else. Now you're an adult. Right. And now you have this glimpse of what the real world is. And this is almost an opportunity to examine it from afar in a way that if you just went right into working 40 or 50 hours a week, you might miss out on a lot of opportunities for examination, reflection, introspection that college can afford somebody like that. While also giving, a young person, a new adult, a much needed sense of independence while they do this.
Yeah. And it's funny for me to even hear myself agree with you on this and make this case, because I have a video where I argue against it as well. Sure. A video where I demonstrate that this is a bad argument for college, in the sense that I would roll my eyes if anyone ever tried to tell an opt-out that they're missing something important because of that. But to be faithful to this question you're asking me about, though, I think if we can do away with the illusion that college is a necessary condition for professional success, or that college is the best way to develop useful skills, or that college is the best way to learn how to create value in the marketplace, that it's the best way to launch your career, if we could dispense with that and get back to the business of saying, for people that have the resources to afford it, and for people who want to be in an environment where there's a greater focus on research and intellectualism, I think college is great for that. I love theoretical research. I believe it's an immensely valuable thing to have deep thinkers sitting around and asking all sorts of abstract questions about everything from minerals to geography to architecture to what the heck is going on out there in space to theoretical physics. I think it's important to have people delve into that kind of stuff, and an environment where people can support those who wanted to do that, and an environment where, you know, people can devote themselves to it. I think that's great. Now, I'm against subsidizing that sort of thing. But for people who want it, I think, why not? Why not have something like that? And I think college will be able to focus on that and do a much better job than they are now if they were not the primary system where people go to prepare for their careers. Because I actually don't think college does such a great job at that. And I think people start off being very confident that it does. But then when you start pushing back they really start moving those goalposts, man. They really start shifting around. Well, it's not about the money. It's about the ideas. Oh, well, it's not just about the ideas. It's about the income statistics. And then when you start picking apart that stuff and forcing people to get honest, you realize that college really isn't delivering on the promises that we're selling. And if this were any other institution, any other kind of business, people would be writing negative reviews. People would be asking for refunds. But college gets insulated from that. Because there's a kind of like religious like devotion to not questioning it or not criticizing it, that it's sort of bad. You're a hater or you're anti-college. But I think it's good. I mean, the very concept of improvement presupposes the acknowledgement of imperfections and flaws. You can't talk about making something better unless you're willing to acknowledge that right now there's something wrong with it.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was the early days of the 2012 presidential campaign, and Rick Santorum criticized President Obama for this notion that everybody should go to college. And I think it became a news story because Santorum said he was a snob or something for saying this. But the media's take on Santorum, who I'm no fan of, was that he's kind of from the Middle Ages. And I remember seeing this concerted effort while this was in the news cycle, this concerted effort to make him the avatar for higher education skepticism. But this extends beyond higher education. There's a very religious and defensive attitude towards all levels of institutionalized schooling in this country.
So, you know, I think there are kind of two reasons why. I think at least 50% of it is just sincere. People mm-hmm. have the very best of intentions, and there are some distinctions that don't often get made in discussions of this nature. You know, when you criticize like compulsory schooling, for instance, mm-hmm. lots of people hear that as criticism of teachers,
yes.
right? So, yep. you know, if you make an argument against compulsory schooling, lots of people respond to that by saying, well, my mom has been a school teacher for 20 years and she's sacrificed her life for these kids. And it's like, that's probably true, man. Mm-hmm. She's probably the most amazing person in the world. But this has nothing to do with that, right? Wherever there are bad systems of this one thing, you can be sure there are good human beings who are participants in that system.
Absolutely, yep.
And they unwittingly perpetuate some of the flaws of that system. So, you know, sometimes distinctions like that don't get made. And a lot of the misunderstanding is sincere. But I do believe there's another dimension to it as well that is not so sincere. And it doesn't get talked about a lot. But there are a lot of political powers that be. And I don't even say this in some deep esoteric conspiratorial sense. But there are lots of people who would lose a lot of money, who would immediately become irrelevant, who would lose their careers if we started to question the traditional system of education. It would put a lot of people out of business if we changed the way we did business. And you don't just see this in academia. You see this in any kind of system where change is imminent. There are always people in that system who are incentivized to resist change because change is threatening. It's not just this romantic thing, you know? So like you can't get the automobile without putting an entire industry out of business. And that stinks when people have families and they're trying to provide for themselves. So you better believe that causes a lot of people to sort of resist things, whether they're entirely conscious of why.
Yeah, there were a lot of railroad people, you know, I mean, that was a pretty great industry in the 19th century who died with nothing because they refused to let go. Not that we're in the transportation business, we're in the railroad business, right? We make trains and tracks. And when that was basically compromised by the availability of new transportation technology, people went to their graves not accepting that. And, you know, we see that over and over. How many times did we see that throughout the 20th century? Now in the 21st century, even more, I would say.
Yeah. And you know, I always laugh at a common criticism people make of for-profit schools. You know, like, oh, yeah, nice commercial, you know, oh, yeah, good marketing, but you're selling a product. And I always find it so amusing, this idea that it's grounds for some sort of automatic dismissal of a person's ideas if they're, you know, if they make income for acting on those ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, first of all, I trust people who have skin in the game a lot more. If you truly believe something, I want to see you tie your livelihood to it. Don't treat your beliefs like this distant thing and you don't attach. You have nothing to gain or lose from your alleged faith in the idea. But the funniest thing about it for me is that all of the critics of that idea are people who make money for what they do, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah. who is this person that refuses out of sainthood a check for creating value for others through the use of their talents and gifts? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, college professors make money for what they do.
Yes. Right?
Like, that tuition goes somewhere. That tuition isn't just for bad, unnecessary art on the campus. It also pays the salaries of these professors. Those teachers get paid. I know we always say they don't get paid enough, but we can't treat their opinions either as if it has nothing to do with some kind of financial incentive.
Indeed. So we are going to talk in some detail about TK's college tour of bad arguments in a bit, but I want to lay a little bit more of a foundation here. You talked about studying philosophy in mm-hmm. college, and the takeaway, what I got from that was you really fully realized this love of learning and also the success that came from learning, obviously, a lot of these challenging concepts and putting pieces together. And you were able to transport that into other pursuits, right? You learned how to learn and realized mm-hmm. that could go to many new endeavors. I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about what your philosophy of education is.
Mm. My philosophy of education is non-bureaucratic at its core. And the best way for me to explain it is in contrast with what I see to be the common theme among many other philosophies of education. Regardless of all the particulars and the differences in methodology, there seems to be a common assumption that's held by many educators. And that common assumption is education begins by trying to answer the question, what are the right things for human beings to know?
Yeah.
Right. And everybody's got different answers to that. Some people say, well, you know, the right things for people to know are, you know, like history or politics or how government works, or no. People need to know about economics, or people need to know about, you know, like practical skills. But everybody brings to the table some kind of opinion about what people ought to know. They construct systems around that, and then they try to get people to fit into that. So even when people say noble sounding things like we need more art in schools, what they mean is that my opinion is that the art is the thing that people need to know. And I want to create a system where everybody has to study that. And I advocate a much more decentralized understanding of education. I believe that education does not start with teachers. Mm-hmm. It does not start with the creators of curriculum materials. It does not start with bureaucrats or any of our opinions about what human beings ought to know. Education starts at an individual level with the learner. And the most fundamental and important question of education is to ask the learner, what are the results you most want to create? I, as a teacher, and what I know only becomes relevant once I have the answer to that. Every teacher and every teacher's knowledge is a servant to the goals of the learner. And if the learner doesn't care about what you know, mm-hmm. what you know is irrelevant unless you can take responsibility for selling that learner on why what you know is important in relation to their goals. Now, that's a big burden. That's a huge responsibility, because now you don't get to hide behind coercion. Now you don't get to tell yourself things like, well, nobody's interested in the truth these days. Or you don't get to tell yourself, well, listen here, Johnny, you're going to study physics whether you like it or not because it's good for you. Now you have the burden of saying, okay, well, I think physics is important. I think reading is important, but clearly you don't. Mm. So now I have the responsibility of trying to get to know you, of listening to you, to see what it is you care about. And then if I truly believe that what I know is important, I have the burden of trying to establish a connection between what you care about and what I want you to care about. To me, that's the heart of education.
Right.
It's helping people. It's understanding people's goals and helping them learn the things necessary to achieve those goals. To be an educator begins with becoming a student of the individuals that we seek to educate.
Right. Education begins with a voluntary learner. When I was a teacher, I was a teacher of subjects. And I found very quickly, like I didn't last too long. I was out of the classroom before I was 30, but I realized this palpable resentment using that framework for education, that I am a teacher of a subject. I experienced resentment directed towards individual students for their lack of interest. I mean, towards the end, the school was small enough, the classes were small enough that as I had to accept my own failures as a teacher, I started to pay more attention to these things and I started to shift into this second framework that you're talking about, this voluntary learner, when I realized what I was doing was pointless. Day after day, all of these things that I thought were so interesting about American history or world history having absolutely no impact, eventually I had to start reevaluating what I was doing, how I was trying to do it. So I totally agree with you. You know, education begins with the learner. Do you ever catch yourself still, or did you ever catch yourself stuck in that first model of education, right? People should know this. People should learn this. It happened to me like 3 days ago. I was reading this book called Grammatical Man. It's an obscure book from the 1980s about information theory. And
What's the name of that?
Grammatical Man.
That sounds good. I got to check it out.
It is by Jeremy Campbell. It's almost in reach. There it is. Information, Entropy, Language, and Life.
I got to get that.
All right. So early in the book, he's talking about Norbert Wiener. Are you familiar with Norbert Wiener?
I am not.
He was the inventor of cybernetics. And they're talking about I'm going to try and do this really quickly, like information as novelty, that if you think about the human thirst for novelty. So this is where my mind takes it in a negative direction. I'm reading this paragraph and I'll explain it in a little bit, but I go, oh, school has just poisoned people, you know, because learning is about novelty. It is about that discovery. It's what makes the movie The Usual Suspects good, right? It is that it exploits and tortures your lack of knowing till the very last moment. And then when it delivers the answer, when it reveals, you know, who the bad guy is, it makes a pretty mediocre movie seem great, right? That revelation, that's learning. Mm. And every day in the 21st century, people go to their devices, they go to their computer and they hit refresh to see new things and new things on YouTube, on Facebook, on Twitter, while having this, again, this is very cynical, pause to say this is very cynical, negative avoidant attitude towards learning. And then in my mind, I say valuable things. And there's this contradiction that as they embrace so much of the novelty that this technology affords them, in ways that they could grow intellectually, they're only using that same technology to confirm their existing biases. So I'm holding this book and I catch myself just completely off course from what the paragraph was about, because it's information as novelty. And I go, look at me. Does that happen to you still? And how do you deal with that if it does?
I think this is great. You're saying so many good things here. There are so many different paths we could go down. So first, I should make it clear that I do believe there are some things that are valuable for everyone to know.
I do too.
And I believe there are certain things that people ought to know. So when you read something like that and you get that sense like, man, it bothers me that people aren't interested in this, I think you're identifying a real problem that we should try to solve. I just don't think we can solve it through coercion. I think we have to solve it by challenging ourselves to be more creative rather than being lazy by forcing others to sit there and listen to us talk about things that are boring to them. I think that's lazy because we're running from the challenge of taking what is boring to someone and presenting it in a way that's interesting to them, because that requires all the hard work of letting other people talk and listening to what makes them tick and so forth. But so the way I struggle with this sometimes is when I come across that information and I say, oh my gosh, everybody's got to know this. Everybody's got to know this. I sometimes don't want to do the hard work of demonstrating the compassion and empathy and curiosity towards other human beings that would put me in a position where I can earn the right to teach them. You know, I believe it was John Maxwell who said something to the effect of, you'll make far more friends by showing interest in other people than by trying to get other people to be interested in you. And on my lazier days, on my less noble days, I just want people to be interested in what I want them to be interested in. But on my nobler days, I say, well, we have plenty of time for my interest. Why don't I earn the right to speak into other people's lives by showing them that I actually care? It's analogous to being a parent. You know, oh, you know that on those lazy days, if you just want the kids to be quiet so you can get some things done, you know you can use that magic box. You turn on the television, you sit them in front of it, it hypnotizes them and subdues them, and you got an easy out,
mm-hmm.
right? But you know that that's not always the best way. But there are days where you just feel like, but oh my gosh, I just don't have any time for this. You know, I'm just so busy. I got to do it. I got to do it. And I'm not saying that that there's never a time where we don't all make a lazy choice like that. But we also have to work to remember that the easy way isn't always the best way. So that's how it kind of shows up for me, you know, when it comes to that educational challenge.
Mm. So I've been really excited to get into this with you. These bad college arguments.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to pick a couple of your favorites and talk about them, because this is very useful for people in my audience as well. People mm-hmm. who are, you know, at least promoting the idea of choice when it comes to higher education. I mean, we spend a lot of time on School Sucks talking about choice at lower levels of education. I think maybe 3 out of my last 5 shows were about unschooling. So mm-hmm. I think this is very useful information. I want people to go to the Praxis YouTube channel and start watching these videos. You're going to continue to do this for a while, I assume?
So I actually have, one more episode left. I promise 8, I'm going to do 8. Mm-hmm. And who knows? Maybe I'll come back with the second season. It depends on what people want. You know, if people are interested and the questions and objections keep coming in, maybe I'll do more. I'm open.
What kind of feedback have you gotten so far?
So far, I get a lot of feedback from college opt-outs or people who went to college and found their degree to be relatively irrelevant. Mm. And they say things like, I've always felt this way. And you finally put words to something that I always knew. Or, you know, I would always get stumped by this and I knew there was something wrong with that argument, but you helped me see it. And I have a lot of opt-outs who step up and say, I have so much more ammo now because every time I go home, everyone challenges me on my choice. I love my life and I'm doing fine, but it's a big burden to have to make sense out of my life to other people who don't get it. And you helped me with that. So the feedback has been tremendously positive. And I occasionally get some people who I don't know if they're trying to be antagonistic or not. I don't really care, but they'll throw out a good objection too. One that makes me step back and say, hey, I like that one. That's a challenging one. I haven't thought about that before. Let's see how I can intellectually honestly wrap my mind around that one. What would I say to someone who's going through that? So the responses have been absolutely fantastic. I'm having a ton of fun doing this.
That's awesome. You know, one of the things that I picked up from watching just the first couple, I've seen them all. How many are out?
So we have 7 of them out.
Oh, I've only seen 5. I needed to check back. But just watching the first couple, one of the things that I picked up was I think, and I was talking to a filmmaker named Jeremy Stewart, who made a movie just a couple days ago. We were having a discussion about failure. He made a movie called Class Dismissed, which was about taking kids out of school and pursuing some kind of home education or unschooling path. So I was talking about nebulous, socially reinforced bad feelings that come with these alternative choices. Like if you make a choice like to opt out of college or something that is just off the tracks, there's a kind of conditioning that even if a person looks like very free thinking and empowered, there can still be the impact of a social conditioning. And I've felt this several times in my life. Like when I would leave a job because I didn't feel like I was helping kids or I didn't feel like this was really education, first I would feel bad. First I would feel like a failure, right? Because everybody mm-hmm. else could do this, right? That's something that was really schooled into me. If I couldn't do a thing or wouldn't do a thing that everybody else would do, there was some kind of defect in me. Right. And now that is an unhealthy thought. It's very unconscious, but it's heavy at the same time. Right. It never really is made explicit in my mind, but it's there. And I think what you're doing with these videos could certainly provide relief from like people having. I mean, doubt is certainly OK to have about our choices, and reevaluating our choices is good, even if they seem to be working out for us. But hearing somebody make these things explicit, right? Especially when most of what they've heard, like somebody watching this video who opted out of college, most of what they heard about their choice was likely to be, at best, constructive criticism, you know?
Right.
So I could certainly envision a free thinking, but maybe not 100% confident youngster getting a lot of relief and reassurance from what you're doing in these videos.
Yeah, you know, and one of the surprises for me, and I say this with earned empathy, because I was not empathetic towards it at first.
Sure.
But I had to work for it. But one of the surprises to me was there were a number of people, particularly people who were fond of their college experience or who were college professors, who felt like, man, why do you have to do this? I mean, isn't this being anti-college? I mean,
right.
Everybody knows that there are different ways to educate people, and some, you know, college isn't for some people or whatever, but why do you have to, you know, pick on bad arguments for college? Why not pick on bad arguments for opting out? Why not treat both things equally? Mm. And it was surprising to me because for me, the issue isn't theoretical. I actually work with college opt-outs in my day-to-day life. And so I'm very close to the kinds of issues they deal with, the sorts of things that are said to them by family, by friends, and so forth. So for me, this isn't just like, hey, I read a book or I watched a TED talk on it. I'm very involved with college opt-outs. And so I'm highly sensitive to it. But there are a number of people who just didn't understand why something like this would even be necessary. And it helped me realize that many people still make the assumption that the conversation about higher educational alternatives is a fair conversation, that everything is on equal footing and it's just like, hey, different strokes for different folks. Mm. And that's not true at all. Because the default responses we have to college opt-outs, as you have just pointed out, is radically different, predictably different from the default college response, from the default response we have to people that attend college. Here's one example of this. Everyone who is on Facebook that has, you know, over 100 friends, or any friend that has a family member that announces that they just got accepted into college, you're going to get a predictable response to that. You're going to get a bunch of congratulations. Great job. And I think that's fine. That mm-hmm. doesn't bother me. That's great, right? But we treat getting accepted into college as if it's an achievement. We don't respond to that by saying, okay, I see that you got accepted into Duke University, but I'm cautiously optimistic. Have you thought about your reasons why you're going? Have you declared a major yet to ensure you don't waste time? You know, have you thought critically about how you're going to use your degree to further? No, we don't do that, right? We say congratulations. On the other hand, if you have someone in your life who says they're opting out of college, you know, they want to start a business, or, you know, they want to go to trade school, or they want to spend a year, you know, traveling or just getting a job while they figure things out, even though in the short term there are financial benefits with that and everything, and it's actually a good thing for someone to not rush into a major decision, mm-hmm. like taking a year to work, whatever, that can actually be a good thing. The default response that we have is one of fear and skepticism. We get nervous around that kind of person. And yeah. I'm not saying that that's bad. I'm not saying that that's a difficult thing to understand, but the existence of that distinction means that there's one group of people that receives far less support and much more skepticism than another group of people.
Yeah.
And I want to be one of the people who provide that.
Right. Oh, there is a greeting card in just about any drugstore for the first choice you described, mm-hmm. not for the second choice, right? And the congratulations card doesn't have any of those very pertinent questions in it, right? How is the career field look in 4 years after you finish for this major, and have you picked this major? I think when there's this culture of middle school students who are expecting to graduate, right? Because obviously it's a pretty cemented idea that if you don't finish high school, the word failure could be applied to that, or at least the feeling of failure can be applied to that. That's the culture. When a middle schooler who's expecting to graduate in 2023 is told no, you know, your real graduation year, and this is happening around the country, your real graduation year is 2027, because that's when you finish college, right? So now, if not graduating is failure, that is extended to going to college at this point. Middle schoolers, high schoolers are being told that. Your graduation year is when you finish college. So I think having an answer to that is very valuable.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, when you're told from the time if we look at elementary and secondary education, the way things are approached, it's treated as if the primary goal of education is to prepare people for college, that college is the goal. Mm. And that once you make it to college, college kind of takes it from there. It prepares you for adulthood. It prepares you to be a complete human being, so forth. So most of what people do at the elementary, secondary level is to make sure they are equipped to succeed in college and equipped to get into a good college. So when parents and their children alike have been sort of conditioned with that belief, it's been reinforced every single day, they develop a very good ability to imagine the child being all right in college. And yeah. We don't have a good ability to imagine what that might look like outside of college. And so our only concept of succeeding outside of college is to be Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg. And it's like, hey, Mark Zuckerberg or bust, right? And that's a tremendous amount of pressure if you want to opt out, because it's like, wait a minute, you mean you can get a college degree and you can be working at Starbucks, which is all good. I actually respect people who work at Starbucks. I think that's so much more impressive than calling yourself a CEO. But you can have a college degree in something, go work at Starbucks. You can hate your job. You can complain about it all the time. And that's normal and acceptable because, you know, life isn't easy and, you know, just keep plugging away. On the other hand, you can be a college opt out. And if you're not Steve Jobs, anything less than that, you know, we're going to look at that and be like, yeah, you know, well, you probably could have done better if you went to college. If you struggle at all, well, yeah, you might not have that struggle if you have a degree. If you struggle to get a job, well, if you had a degree, you'd get one. When you have a degree, you don't deal with that. We blame it on reality. If you have a degree, you did what you were told and you can't get a job and you're struggling. Oh, well, the economy is tough. Reality is hard. Or let us figure out how we can support you. Maybe you need more resources. Well, maybe you should go about it this way. But we're not going to blame your educational choice. But if you're a college opt out, you've got to be on your A game and you've got to crush it at everything you do. Because if you fail to get a job or you struggle for 3 months to pay your rent, we're going to be all over that telling you, well, that's because you didn't go to college.
Right.
So that's a lot of pressure, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's talk about that, not just in terms of college as an opportunity cost for many people, but also college as this extension of a passive, permission-based approach to life that extends into adulthood from a very, very early age. And I'm somebody who attended a lot of college for a lot of years.
And it started, you know, I think I was like 12 years old or maybe even younger than that, maybe like 10. And I said, I'd like to get in front of a microphone or a camera somehow. Like that was like the 10-year-old thought. And my biggest interest at the time was sports. So I was like, yeah, if I could do like the play-by-play for baseball games, that would be cool. That'd be a cool thing. So there was this need or this desire as a reflection of who I was to do this thing. And my parents found me, I think I was like 11 or 12 at the time, they found me this sports caster and sports writer camp in New Hampshire. I was the youngest kid there by 4 or 5 years. And I went to this camp. And then, you know, I became kind of a wayward teen, didn't really think much about the future or what I wanted to do. And college felt very much like the 13th grade. And it came time to pick a major. And I said, you know, I had that interest when I was younger. Something was like driving me. There was something about me that like wanted to entertain or wanted to convey information through these channels. Like I always admired people who did that. I knew all the sportscasters in Boston were, or those were my teams growing up. So I knew who all these people were. And I said, well, I'm going to major in communications because I had this. It seemed like an almost unconscious decision. You know, I got this college degree, graduated in 2000. I already talked about how professionally it was worthless. I knew how to do nothing. And I found myself going to radio stations and television stations like in upstate New York, Albany, New York, and just trying to get sales jobs, right? Because that was the industry that I had a degree in. I had a bachelor's degree in communications. You know, I'm looking for entry-level positions, not doing what I wanted to do. And that was the reality, right? The reality that you're talking about, the industry had changed while I was in college. And I eventually, just through, you know, the right exposures in college, I had a history professor who was great in college. I had an opportunity to work at a boarding school that was in the town where I went to college. So I just started to shift into education and realized that it was satisfying that same thing in me. To present, to entertain, to convey information that, yeah. You know, I had always felt a real drive to do. So I eventually became a teacher and eventually, you know, I found my own way. Luckily, you know, I mean, I wouldn't have this story if all this was happening in the 70s, but I found my way to the microphone, you know, but it was very much my own way. And I'm very grateful that it happened, that I had the, you know, I was exposed to media producers that I liked. And I said, oh, I think I could do this, and found a way to do it. But I remember almost 20 years ago wandering around Albany, New York with that bachelor's degree in search of somebody who had the power to give me permission to do what I wanted to do, or at least to start the process of clawing my way into doing what I wanted to do, and feeling just incredibly hopeless through the whole ordeal. I hate to think that people are still out there feeling this way today.
You know, I think when we're not playing a game of let's dodge the philosopher,
yeah,
we find that that's a very common experience, right? But in order to get people to be honest about that, you have to drop the whole debate about college versus opting out, and you've got to put it on neutral grounds, because when people feel defensive about something, they won't make normal concessions. They won't be transparent about how they really feel. But just go out there in the world, and in a world, you know, where people have college degrees, just go out there and talk to people about how they're living. You know, there's a reason why the self-help industry is a $1 billion industry. You know, there's a reason why tons of people are spending money on books about how to feel better, how to love themselves, how to love their life, how to cope with stress at work. It's not like we live in a world where, you know, everybody's just like blissfully happy and feeling like they're doing what they love, and everybody's just like following their passion, and the degree has, you know, met this need. And I'm not saying we should put pressure on degrees to do all that, but there is a lot missing in terms of our relationship to work. And I think we have to put some of that blame on the fact that we need more innovation and critical thinking in the arena of how we prepare people for this thing that we call work. And we can't be so defensive about criticizing college that we irresponsibly abandon the opportunity to rethink the way we're doing things, you know?
Sure.
So I just think that's an important thing to say. But, you know, when it comes to your career journey, for me, I don't think that was luck. Yeah, there are variables in every story, but I don't think that was luck. I think that's how reality works. I believe that your best chances of succeeding are living your life in such a way that you create your own map. It's not about following someone else's map. It's about creating your own map, because every human being is an unrepeatable event,
right?
And you've got to find what it is about your curiosities and your capacities that is unrepeatable, that is irreplaceable, because that's the thing that puts you above the plane of competition and on the plane of creativity. I'm not threatened by the possibility of anyone taking my job, not because I think I'm better than everyone else, but because I know how unique I am, that nobody even wants what I want.
Right.
It's not that you can't beat me at the game that I'm playing. It's that the game that I'm playing is so optimized for me, it would put the rest of the world to sleep. Right. No one is interested in my game but me. And that's the level you want to get to in life, where you're the only one who even wants to play the game you're playing,
yeah,
because it's so connected to your own curiosities and interests that you become the dominator of that game.
Yeah.
And when people look to what can be provided from those game players, they look to you. That's how reality works. But the problem with that approach is not that it doesn't work. It's not that we don't have enough stories illustrating how that works. The problem with that is it doesn't put you in a situation where you can easily explain your life at a cocktail party.
Right.
Because if you talk to all of the interesting people that do interesting things and you hit the pause button somewhere in the middle of their story, that story sounds reckless.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that story doesn't put them in a position where they can give everyone a comfortable, understandable label for what they are and what they're doing. Even though you're doing the thing that everyone's going to praise you for when you get there, it's hell along the way. And so we underestimate just how important of a role that plays in people's educational and career choices. It's not just about what makes them passionate and fulfilled. It's also about what makes it easier for them to explain their lives to other people. And so a lot of people choose the path of conformity because at least you can tell people, you know, what you're going to be doing for the next 5 years.
Right.
At least you can have people not worry about you or nag you. And I think one of the biggest reasons people don't take more chances, people don't pursue more educational alternatives, people don't follow their dreams, is because you have to explain your life to other people. And that's really difficult when you're in the process of manufacturing your own meaning, because there is no sense you can give. You're in the process of creating it.
Oh, yeah. And eventually that creation has enough of a definite shape that explaining it to other people becomes fun. But I definitely remember being apprehensive about it in the past.
And I think the point of the story that I was telling, the point when I've told that story before, is contrasting self-knowledge, like living consciously, against a kind of permission mentality, right? Mm-hmm. So I had this drive. I had this set of needs I was trying to meet, but I never really brought it into focus. I couldn't bring it into focus when I was 12, when I was 15, when I was 18, when I got into teaching in my early 20s. Because I had never encouraged myself or really been encouraged to do that. I was graduating from college and taking this degree out into the world where it's like, now that I have this permission slip, who's going to give me permission to do this thing that I want to do? Right? That was 20 years in the making, that 21-year-old's mentality, not realizing that all along I knew. And I just had to pay attention to that, and I had to bring that into focus more. I had to make that explicit. And, you know, that's what I promote on the show, is giving kids the option of doing that today, whether they're very young, and obviously it's going to change and it could be completely revolutionized by the time they become adults, but certainly by the time they get to college age, right? To know themselves more than knowing who they need to ask if it's okay to do what they want to do.
And you know what's amazing about that is, you know, someone might be listening to this and they may say, well, okay, well, how do we teach that? How do we build that into the curriculum? And the great thing about it is you don't have to teach that. That's an innately human thing. And if you pick any individual, the further you go back in time, the more you find evidence that that is the very thing that lies at the core of their being, that self-knowledge is obtained through play.
Yeah.
And if you want to help people cultivate a sense of self-knowledge, then get out of the way and let them play. We got ourselves a t-shirt, brother.
It reminds me, like, so when I was 10, and this is just like the nice finish to that whole story that I tell, I used to put on a baseball uniform and go out in my backyard and play entire baseball games by myself and do the play-by-play for them, right? And this was, to all the neighbors, the weirdest thing they'd ever seen, but it was the thing that I looked forward to the most. Now, that sounds weird to even say now, but having that experience, I think, was really what started to push me in that whole direction.
I love that, man. And it kind of goes back to what you were saying about novelty earlier. It's one of the interesting things about the relationship between the brain and novelty is that novelty is kind of like this prerequisite for pleasure. We have a very limited capacity to experience fulfillment in the absence of novelty, right? So one example of this is if you give a child a new toy for Christmas, the first thing they want to do is they want to play with it all day. Or you give them a new video game, right? When my dad would get us a video game for Christmas, my brother and I, we'd like lock ourselves in our room and play all day.
Right.
And the instinctive fear of any parent or a teacher is to be like, uh-oh, if I let them do that, they're just going to literally play that video game forever. And then one day they're going to be 45 and they'll be Rip Van, you know, Wrinkle, right? Mm-hmm. But it's actually the other way around. We never get to see how this process ends because we never let it go far enough out of fear. But the brain will actually take care of this, because if that child gets enough time with that toy or that video game, after maybe 2 weeks, they're going to be bored with it. And if you're a parent, you know this because it shows up in the form of the continual pressure of buying new toys. Mm-hmm. You will never be so lucky as a parent to buy your child one toy and one video game and they'd be happy for life. They always want a new one because their brain says, I'm not going to let you have any more fun unless you take on a new challenge, unless you learn something new. And because the game has become easy for them and they can't learn anything more, the brain says, well, unless you learn something new, you don't get to have any more fun. And so what does that process look like, man? When we get out of the way and create a space where, you know, we still make sure people are safe and so forth. You want to create a context within which people can explore safely and you can minimize risk. But what happens to the learning process when we're not so afraid of people, you know, becoming like one dimensional or not getting enough history or not getting enough math, what happens is they go down the path of curiosity and their brain says, okay, no more pleasure for you, learn something new. And then they learn something new, brain says, no more pleasure for you, learn something new. And now you have a kid who started off playing video games, but now they're reading graphic novels. Now they're learning Chinese. Now they've got friends across the globe. And it's going down all kinds of paths that you couldn't have predicted. And then, boom, years later, they have a job that didn't even exist when they first started playing that video game.
Right.
Because that job was a perfect reflection of the person they became along the path of curiosity.
Right. Gosh. On the other hand, though, this is what I got so bent out of shape about reading Grammatical Man earlier this week, gosh, you know, why aren't people looking for novelty through, you know, all these people, and as I sit in my bed criticizing society, why aren't people looking for novelty through their work, through ideas? You know, people drone in and out of this job, and they watch CNN because it confirms their biases and reinforces what they already believe or whatever they watch to achieve that same outcome. And meanwhile, they need novelty in all of these unproductive ways and all of these unhelpful ways. That was the thought that I had. That was what got me upset.
Yeah. Well, you know, those examples you gave, though, I think that's not the problem. That's the symptom of a problem.
Sure. Yeah.
That began a long time ago. You see, when people feel like they are living in a prison, whether that prison be physical or psychological or spiritual, they respond by trying to escape. So when you see people seeking out mind candy or, you know, going down the path of addiction and all these other sorts of things, that's not what humanity looks like when you encourage people to follow your passion. That's what humanity looks like when they've lived 15 to 20 years of being told that their passions, that their curiosities ought to take second place to a bunch of boring stuff that even their teachers don't want to study. You know, when you take curiosity out of a person and you force them to live a lifestyle where they're prioritizing something above and beyond what they're actually interested in, well, that's what you get. You get people who grow up, become adults, they feel tired, worn out, they feel like their lives are uninteresting, and they're looking for the next piece of mind candy to help them generate a sensation of escape from their miserable lives. It's why people trade in 9 to 5 for a weekend of freedom.
Absolutely.
Not because they are free, but because that's what happens when people's freedom is taken away and they live their whole lives in bondage.
Yeah, like in the 1950s and or 60s when the oceanographer Jacques Cousteau said, we really can't expect to learn anything about these whales studying them at the aquarium. Like that's because this was always my criticism. In towards the end of my career in education, the what's wrong with kids conversation that would come up, whether it was, you know, more of through a finger quotes therapeutic approach, through trying to figure it out through the DSM-4, the DSM-5. Could we stop and look at the environment? Like the thing we never question, right? The thing that is off the table is the environment. So it's like, all right, the expectation is you will conform to this environment. Once that is off the table for debate, the goodness or the helpfulness of this environment, let's talk about what's wrong with you. Let's figure out why you're defective for not fitting in here. Yeah, it's a very good point. And as we're talking about, it extends way beyond that.
I 100% agree that there's a book by James P. Carse that I love called Finite and Infinite Games, a Vision of Life as Play and Possibility.
Yes.
And one of the rules of play is that he who must play cannot play, right? That play requires an absence of coercion. So even if there are constraints built into the game, there must be the sense of me voluntarily agreeing to adhere to those constraints. So I believe that Carse's rule of play is also true of learning. That if it is the case that he who must play cannot play, I believe it is also the case that he who must learn cannot learn. Now, what you can achieve through coercion is you can achieve memorization, good test taking. You can achieve a certain threshold of being able to replicate certain results and so forth. But when it comes to the deep kind of learning that produces creativity, there are possibilities born of curiosity that simply are not born out of duty. I'll give you an example. When you were a kid, did your parents ever like make you take out the garbage?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's a question for you. When your parents made you do that and you took the garbage outside, did you ever say, I'm going to go do that for all the neighbors too.
No. No.
Predictably, no. Right? I knew that I was safe asking this question. I'm sure there's one person who's going to write in the comments, well, I did that.
Right.
But there's an easy answer why. There's an easy answer why. Because it would be absurd for you to do it. Because the only reason why you were taking out the garbage is because someone else required you to do so. So if you're doing something because you're obligated to do it, then it is rational for you to do it up until the point where you can avoid getting in trouble, and then you stop, because there is literally no other reason to go further than that, right? If the entire basis for you doing something is, I get in trouble if I don't do it, it becomes right. irrational for you to continue doing it beyond the point of getting in trouble, because that's your only reason for doing it.
Yes.
On the other hand, if you have an additional reason for doing it, like, I love this, I'm interested in this, I'm curious about this, you always go beyond what is required, because that is the very nature of love. It's why when you were in high school and you didn't want to be on the phone, but you felt like you had to be, your conversation was like 15 minutes. But when you were talking to that girl, you like, you know, the conversation was like irresponsibly long, like 4 hours long, even though you knew that you shouldn't be on the phone for 4 hours, because love causes you to do that. It causes you to go beyond, you know, right. what is required. Think about the first time you may have fell in love, and all the things we do when we fall in love. We write poetry, we give creative gifts, we find all these meaningful ways of expressing to someone else that we're interested in them. Do you think that would come out of us if we chose our dating partners because mother said, well, you're going to take Sandy out on a date whether you like it or not? Oh no, mom, I don't want to take Sandy out on a date. Well, you're going to do that. Well, what's that date going to be like? It's going to be you doing exactly what your mother told you to do.
Yes.
And nothing more. Right?
Yeah. And then I have to make her a mixtape. Ugh.
right. You're not going to make a mixtape.
Exactly.
For Sandy. but that's the thing. And so you can't coerce that kind of creativity, but it comes out naturally when you do create a context where people are able to experiment and explore. And to bring it around to higher education, the work that we're doing with Praxis, and my criticisms of college, here's actually one of the most important things to kind of tie the knot on this whole play thing. There seems to be a big crisis in our time of young people not knowing what they want to do, looking for direction, trying to find meaning. So many books and courses are offering people a way of like figuring out their passion. Well, what's the personality test I can take that tells me I'm in the right place? Reality actually has a built-in mechanism for discovering what you're passionate about, what you're good at, and what makes you tick. It's called experimentation. And the way that you figure out what you want to do and what you need to be doing and what you're born to do isn't by finding and following your passion. It's by experimenting with your curiosity. But here's the problem. The cost of doing that has become artificially inflated to such an extent that reality's built-in mechanism for discovering what you're born to do is now this like pressure-filled, anxiety-ridden, yes. stressful process that people can no longer tap into. So, you know, when you think about decisions that people make, the pressure that we feel when we make those decisions is based on what we perceive the cost of making the wrong decision to be.
Yeah.
So if I'm buying a toaster, I don't stress out too much. If I'm buying ice cream, I don't stress out too much. Because even if I get this decision wrong, it's not a high cost for being wrong.
Right.
So it's not that I make smart decisions when it comes to ice cream. I experiment, and I'm free to experiment because there's a very low cost of being wrong. If I try a new flavor and I don't like it, it's okay. I just get something different. When it comes to getting married, for instance, oh, that's a big decision. Mm-hmm. And right. so you experience a lot more stress, and you're much more careful about, you know, the decision you make there. Because the cost of being wrong is really high. When you look at the cost of the current model of higher education, the opportunity cost is on average 5 to 6 years in your prime, in
yes.
your prime.
Yeah.
And then the transaction costs, you know, most people, I believe the number is near 70% graduate with student debt. Your transaction costs somewhere in the arena of, you know, close to six figures, you know, conservatively, maybe we say 60,000 to six figures. Well, that's a high cost of being wrong. So if you go to school and you study elementary education and you graduate and you discover that you don't like kids, ooh, you know, there's nothing wrong with that discovery, but boy, spending 6 years and six figures to figure that out, that's tough. That's really tough. And so people are anxious precisely because the dominant model for how they go about preparing for adulthood is one that makes the process of experimenting with their curiosities feel like getting married. And the way that we change that is by changing that educational model to one that says work is a tool for self-discovery. It is not a marriage. You are not going to be working at your first job or your second job or your third job for the majority of your life. You are free to try things. That's why Praxis says we don't need 5 years of your life.
Right.
That's absurd. We're not going to ask for 5 years of your prime. Come do 1 year and you don't need to pay six figures. $12,000 is fine. Come do 1 year. You'll make all that money back by the time you graduate the program. And if you crush it at your business partner, they'll offer you a full-time job, but you don't even need that. You can go do whatever else you want to do because you've only given up 1 year of your life. You've developed some useful skills. You've worked in a startup and discovered something valuable about what you love, what you hate, where you want to take your life. And you didn't sacrifice your prime in order to figure that out. That's how you're supposed to discover what you're born to do. And that's one of the problems that we're solving in education. We are reducing those artificially inflated costs of experimenting with your curiosity. And we're making it easier for human beings to discover through work what it is they want to do and how they want to live.
And they can leave this program with a philosophy of work that's quite portable. I think you mentioned that at the end. And that's really valuable. I don't think people get that through the traditional higher ed experience.
Absolutely.
I'm coming up against a hard break, unfortunately. We didn't even start the outline that I wrote. Do you think, and I did see this as an introductory kind of conversation, do you think I could have you come back in the near future and we could do maybe more long-form discussion on the college tour of bad arguments?
I'd love to. We can dive into the tour. I'd love to hear maybe from you and your audience what you think the strongest pro-college arguments are, and nothing is off limits, and I'd be happy to address them. You know, we can talk about some of the ones that I did cover. We can cover whatever you want. This is one of my favorite topics in the world, and I love talking about it. So let's definitely do a round two.
Absolutely. Well, I really like the form that this conversation took. It was really great getting to know you, and I definitely look forward to talking more in the future.
Hey, Brett, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Okay, so let's get into Grammatical Man, and I'll lay some groundwork here. In the Second World War, the British had a problem. British got lots of problems, okay, over the last 500 years. But in World War II, their ground guns are entirely powerless against German bombers, which can now fly higher and faster than they could during the First World War. In fact, a statistical analysis revealed for every enemy plane British anti-aircraft guns shot down, 10,000 rounds of ammunition needed to be spent. And in the war room, they said, "This is outrageous! Our citizens should not be taxed! Just so 9,999 bullets that didn't hit anything can rain down upon them!" Just kidding, no one said that. So, Norbert Wiener, a mathematician, and as I mentioned in the show, the founder of cybernetics, was put to work on solving this problem. Developing a method, basically, in very simple terms, to predict every possible location one of these German planes could be from the moment when the anti-aircraft gun was fired to when one of the rounds could hit the plane. And then decide on the most probable location of the plane. So we'll pick it up there. Page 29. Predicting where a German plane would be a few seconds hence so that gun crews can aim the shell ahead and hit the target is a problem for statistics to solve. The probable path of a plane is treated as one of many possible paths. The task of separating messages from noise is also accomplished statistically. Messages display a certain pattern, and the patterns change in a manner determined partly, but only partly, by their past history. This was a clean break with determinism. At the time, it was a surprising discovery.
In a larger sense, it helped to establish the conceptual framework of the new theory of information, which burst onto the scene 3 years after the war was over. The classical theory of communication, which had begun to be undermined in the 1920s, was deterministic, Newtonian. It treated messages as single events. Wiener decisively cut the chains of this old way of thinking. He recognized that to speak of one fixed item of information, a signal, a letter on a page, a blip on a radar screen, makes no sense. In an ordinary conversation, information is conveyed when the speaker says something that changes the listener's knowledge. This means that the listener is in a state of uncertainty as to what message he will actually hear. We say uncertainty rather than complete ignorance, because he does know at least that the message will be one of a range of possible messages. It may be highly improbable, and therefore very hard to predict, or it may be extremely probable, in which case the listener could have predicted it with ease. But the message will not be impossible in the sense that it violates grossly the rules of grammar or meaning. Otherwise, it could not be called information at all. In the listener's mind, as in the statistician's charts and tables, are a number of possibilities or contingencies, some more probable than others. When the speaker sends his message, he makes one of these possibilities actual, excluding the others and resolving the listener's uncertainty. However, we should take careful note of the fact that a greater amount of uncertainty is resolved if the message chosen is one of a large number of possible messages, and if it is one of the more unlikely of these possibilities. For that reason, an actual message must be considered not in isolation, but in its relation to all possible messages, just as the actual path of the plane is part of a pattern that includes other possible paths. This is a central point of importance in information theory, which is statistical to its very bones. The masters of the mystery novel, to give another example, are at pains to ensure that the reader's uncertainty is maintained until the very last moment, when the villain, finally unmasked, will turn out to have been a possible suspect, but a highly improbable one. And that's where I got all pissed. Okay, that's it. Tomorrow, check out meeting number 6 of The Discomfort Zone. And ooh, it was an uncomfortable one. Also, I'd just like to say The Discomfort Zone is a almost weekly bonus show that I do with my good friend Andrew. It's a personal development themed. We talk about current challenges that could be professional, emotional, related to relationships. And we dig in and we try and solve those problems. We're bringing in guests now. We're experimenting with some format changes in the near future. But we've received great feedback on these conversations so far. They are available to people who support us on Patreon or through the AV Club. And right now, I have to say that my nerves are a little frayed with the sort of unexplained removal of content creators from certain platforms. There's actually a couple of things that I'd like to do in 2019, and I'm feeling a little nervous about doing them. If you find what we do valuable, please go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and sign up to be a member of the AV Club. This is our own bonus content section. It is a fucking goldmine of additional School Sucks content, 400 plus hours of audio and video. Some of our greatest material is for supporters only. Over the last year, as I have prioritized other fundraising methods, I have let AV Club membership fall off considerably. And many ants are starting to gather in my pants. So if you've listened to School Sucks for a while, if you get value from this show, if you find it entertaining, if you find that we're offering a unique voice on the problem of institutionalized schooling and the promise of learner-driven education, please support us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. There are 3 tiers. As you go up from the lower tier to the middle tier to the higher tier, you get access to more and more bonus material. But until the end of the year, everyone who signs up at $8 a month, the lower tier, will get full access. Every audio and video file behind that paywall. Now remember, even though much of this content is very revelatory, lots of stuff we don't talk about on the regular show, provocative, and highly amusing, I always try to make the most valuable content that we produce available to the people that I had in mind when I created School Sucks Podcast.
people with no money. At the time, that included high school students and college students. Now, it includes high school students, college students, and almost all college graduates under the age of 37. But you have money, and you can think about it as a sponsorship of one of those people. Because you might not have time to sift through 400 plus hours of additional School Sucks content. You might not have time to sift through me doing freestyle rap songs about autoerotic asphyxiation. You might not have time for my stories about how I shamed a date for her political views and then felt bad about it. You might not have time to listen to me and Tom Woods debate moon landing conspiracy theories. You might not have space in your life for a 35-minute Thaddeus Russell argument that I thought was so bad I had to cut out of a show, or to witness some incredibly awkward moments created by Michael Malice. You might not have time. You might, but you might not. But you still want to support what we do. That's what the AV Club is really for. All that other stuff is just a bonus. It's there if you want it. And I feel like we've created a kind of key ring here of personal liberation. We've talked a lot about critical thinking and learning. We've talked a lot about personal development. We've talked a lot about the vista of alternatives to institutionalized schooling. Many examples in the last handful of shows. But we've also shined a spotlight into the dark corners of the history of public schooling in the United States. And we've helped many of our listeners formulate their own powerful arguments against the school religion. I'm very proud of what we've created. I'm very, very happy that this show exists, but I could not do it without you. Thank you.